Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Before dedicating himself to writing historical books full-time, Fergus Bordewick was a journalist and traveled across Asia, Europe, and the Middle East reporting on politics and human rights. One of his previous books was Clan War, Ulysses S. Grant and the Battle to Save Reconstruction. Fergus Bordewick's latest book is about the celebration of America's first 100 years at the dawn of the Gilded Age. The Great Centennial Exhibition attracted 10 million Americans and visitors from around the world to Philadelphia. The title of this book is Centennial, The Great Fair of 1876 and the Invention of America's Future. Fergus Bordewick, welcome.
Hi, Nancy. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
Now, I mentioned the Gilded Age. Do you have to explain that to people? Do you get a blank stare, or do people know, oh yeah, sure, the Gilded Age?
Well, generally, when I mention the term, people say something like, oh yeah, like right now. But the Gilded Age we should be thinking of was the period after the Civil War, really accelerating in the 1870s and continuing almost to the turn of the 20th century, when American industry became turbocharged, challenged the industrial power of Europe, and generated a great deal of money and conspicuous consumption that often embarrassed and angered Americans whose values were rooted in a simpler, more democratic age.
Well, the date of this fair was, I never paid that much attention to it. But since I've read your book, I relate to that date. For example, this morning I was drinking a bottle of water, and on the cap it says since 1871. And I thought, oh, 5 years before the centennial. Or I wonder if my grandfather was born then. So I looked up, oh, my grandfather was born 3 years after the centennial. So now this date has become so important, I guess, in my own way of viewing things, like 1492 or other dates that people know. But 1876, previous to your reading your book, was not really on my radar screen. So why did you decide to take up this opportunity to write about this centennial?
Well, in a way, it grew out of my previous book, which you've mentioned, Clan War, which was about Ulysses Grant's successful effort to crush the first Ku Klux Klan in the 1870s. And that book more or less concluded with the year that's considered really generally the end of Reconstruction in the South, 1876. So I arrived in the year of 1876, and I more or less stumbled across the fact that the centennial of the nation was being celebrated that year in this extravagant, almost phantasmagoric way in Philadelphia with the country's first World's Fair. And here I saw it sort of juxtaposed against the violence, a terrific terroristic violence that had been taking place in the South. And it seemed such a kind of strange and provocative contradiction as a way of kind of looking at America, which in 1876 was, of course, Americans were taking stock of who would they become in the course of 100 years. When they look back towards the founders, did they feel that they were fulfilling the vision of the founders, or had Americans become different? Had America become different? It intrigued me to start looking at how Americans thought about themselves in that centennial year.
My guest is Fergus Bordewick, and his book is Centennial, The Great Fair of 1876 and the Invention of America's Future. And that word Great Fair, I was astounded just to the size of the space that this fair took up. Why was it held in Philadelphia, by the way?
Well, different cities did compete for it, but Philadelphia from the beginning was far and away at the most likely site because it was where the Declaration of Independence had been signed in 1876. So the symbolism of choosing Philadelphia was overwhelming. And the Great Centennial Exhibition of that year, everybody just called it the Centennial, as I probably will in this conversation. At any rate, on one hand, it was a gigantic exposition of American industry and invention and art. There were 200 buildings, many of them extraordinarily grand pieces of architecture. But at the same time, the Centennial rooted itself in evocations of the American past, the founding in particular. You could see George Washington's breeches and his camp desk and Benjamin Franklin's eyeglasses and things of that sort that evoked the founding and Philadelphia. And on July 4th, 1876, the Centennial celebrated its most important symbolic day right in front of Independence Hall. So the sense of being heirs, Americans being heirs to the founders and forefathers was in everyone's minds.
Well, since you mentioned the artifacts like George Washington's belongings, John Paul Jones' sword, Benjamin Franklin's chess set, another guy's writing desk and a sculpture made of butter, a self-heating iron, and the arm now of the Statue of Liberty, and that the arm holding a torch is on the cover of your book. And I found you also have a photograph inside. I found myself referring to your photograph so many times. I thought, oh, I want to look again at what that guy looked like. For example, you have a character, Thomas Scott. And I thought, oh, he looks like Rock Hudson. And then Walt Whitman, boy, he looks old. So I found myself looking many times at your photographs. The very first photograph is rather mind-boggling. You say that this Centennial exhibition transformed Philadelphia's Fairmont Park into a vast universe of pavilions and halls. And just from that photograph, you could see that thing is huge. Do you remember the dimensions, how long and wide the exhibition was?
I don't want to misquote myself, so I'm not going to say, but okay. it was huge. Anyone familiar with New York's Central Park will get an idea of its extent. Fairmount Park in Philadelphia is roughly comparable to New York's Central Park. It was, as I implied before, just packed with buildings. People wouldn't go for the afternoon. They'd go for a week. They'd go for 2 weeks, even, in order to take everything in. And bear in mind that in 1876, the United States is by and large a much simpler country than it is today, not surprisingly, of course. Most Americans had never seen a department store. They'd go to the Centennial Exhibition and see these spectacular kind of mountainous displays of consumer goods, goods they'd never seen before, inventions that they had barely heard about or never heard about at all. And you wouldn't see just one steam engine in a great hall. You'd see 30 of them lined up. Yeah. And the letters, the diary remarks that people leave after the Centennial make clear that most people, including very sophisticated visitors, were absolutely in awe of what they saw. Both the multiplicity of things, but also the sense of American might and power, industrial power, and indeed even military power, because there is a kind of military element to this as well. Americans are just overwhelmed with who they are. And this exhibition, I should also say, is not only looking towards the past, but looking towards the future, towards what America will become as the 19th century concludes and the 20th begins.
Yeah, in fact, that's in your subtitle, The Invention of America's Future. But I wanted to emphasize the fact that it is a world fair. It's not just Americans. There were 37 nations participating in this exhibition. And I thought it was interesting what they would bring, these various countries, 37 nations participating in this. Do you remember what some of the foreign countries brought to the pavilion or brought to the fair?
Sure. It was pretty varied. Now, virtually all of them, the foreign countries, that is, showcased their own industrial power and creativity and so on. And one country, I believe it was Sweden, had an enormous tower of nails. Yes, nails, N-A-I-L-S. Hundreds of varieties of iron nails. Well, bear in mind that everything in the 19th century, pretty much, not everything, was built with wood, and nails mattered. But in some of these exhibits make you wonder a bit, you know, about the, I'll tell you, but two pavilions or halls that were particularly intriguing, both to me and more importantly to the visitors, were from China and Japan. This was the first time that Asian countries had ever exhibited at any kind of exhibition. And it was certainly the first encounter of Americans with people from Asia. Now, Chinese were numerous on the West Coast in California, where you are, but the Chinese government had a pavilion that intrigued people because it was packed with artwork and handiwork and crafts and things that Americans had just never seen before, who only knew of Chinese, and frankly, in a very, very racist context, because as you well know in California, Chinese were subject to appallingly discriminatory laws and violence. So to see a China in Philadelphia that was immensely intriguing and could present beautiful and artifacts and kind of poetic presentations and so on, was very confusing to Americans. And the other Asian country was Japan, which, as I said, had a pavilion there that intrigued Americans immensely. There were almost no Japanese in America at the time. And Japanese were therefore not subject to the same targeting as Chinese immigrants were. So Americans approached the Japanese with more curiosity and perplexity, and generally an absence of prejudice, okay? And you read newspaper articles about reporters and others trying to come to grips with the Japanese and figure out, what are they like? Who are they? What kind of country is this? Japan also presented very, very beautiful artifacts in large part. And
like a formal garden?
Yes, a beautiful garden. And ironically, the most lasting thing that was presented there for the first time in the Japanese pavilion was a plant called kudzu.
That yeah. used to be a problem. Oh, my gosh. Kudzu took over a lot of property. Yeah, and I found that amusing because I grew up on roads where you would see kudzu on both sides. But now on a more fun kind of note, the Turkish cafe served coffee in small cups.
Americans found that quite intriguing. I think they were, to tell you the truth, probably even more intrigued, at least the male visitors, with the Turkish dancing girls in the cafe.
Yes.
But
now our friends, the French, they brought some carpets, but also they brought stained glass. And where did that stained glass from the French end up?
Yeah, in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have these opening ceremonies with this grand march, but the march wasn't composed by an American. Who composed the music for the march?
Yeah, Richard Wagner. the great German operatic composer, who was recruited and paid the fabulous sum for that time of $5,000 to write a centennial march. Which nobody thought was all that good, to tell you the truth. And I will mention in this context also somebody whose name we all know, Walt Whitman, who desperately wanted, who wrote something called The Song of the Centennial. It was a poem, not one of his best, but he desperately wanted it to be selected as part of the opening day ceremonies to be recited to the public. I mean, you think, I mean, Whitman, of course, is a poet of the first order, but he was also a self-promoter, and he really, really wanted to sell this poem. It would have been, he would have been paid for it, and they turned him down, just cold-shouldered.
You kind of feel sorry for Walt Whitman when you read your book. My guest is Fergus Bordewick, and his book is Centennial, The Great Fair of 1876 and the Invention of America's Future. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Fergus M. Bordewick. His book is Centennial, The Great Fair of 1876 and the Invention of America's Future. Well, the president at that time was President Grant, and when he came, he was with the, or with him, was the Emperor of Brazil. That's kind of funny, having a monarch as well as an elected head of state there at the centennial celebration. Now, since I mentioned the president at the time was President Grant, I learned to really admire the next president. And how did you feel about Rutherford B. Hayes?
Well, to give it some context, we should remember that there was a presidential campaign underway in 1876, one of the most crucial in American history because of issues. Well, it was a year in which the Democratic Party, still tainted by its connections with secession and the Confederacy and opposition to the Civil War and so on, expects to prevail. Why? Because the Grant administration, to some extent unfairly, has been blamed for rampant political corruption. Of course, there's political corruption, but it's a lot of it is a smear against Grant personally. So the Republican Party and the Democratic one both have selected reformers as their candidates in 1876. The Republicans select Rutherford B. Hayes, who, for Americans who may know his name but not know much about him.
Yeah, I knew the name, but I really didn't know enough about him to have feelings pro or con.
Historians often refer to him and a couple of others as the guys with the beard after Lincoln.
But he's an exemplary figure in this book, this President Rutherford B. Hayes. And one thing he said, I'm not going to run. He didn't really want to be elected the first time, but he said, I'm not going to run for a second term. So he made that clear when he started out.
Yeah, he was admirable.
Yeah, and I liked, that made me feel good to read about Hayes, but a lot of what I read in your book, oh, it was, In fact, you have a quote by William Tecumseh Sherman, Civil War hero in the North. He said, "It seems almost too terrible to be entirely true." And so much of what you read, what I read in your book, seemed too terrible to be entirely true. And it just, well, for example, do you remember what it, at the exhibition the most popular eatery was?
Yes, sure. There were innumerable eateries, including a French restaurant and a Tunisian cafe, and so on and so on. However, by far the most popular was called the Southern Restaurant, which served Southern food, but was but the servers, all the staff, were essentially garbed as slaves to evoke a, for Americans of 1876, a kind of old-timey romantic notion of the Old South. I mean, this is makes you cringe today. I underscored it in my book because I think just the fact that that cafe existed, and it was the most important one, most popular one, tells you volumes about the common values of Americans in 1876, that they would find that entertaining.
And you even used the word darkies. They were served by plantation darkies. Well, another piece of art that showed the horrors of war was the painting of Gettysburg.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Do you want to say anything about that painting?
Sure. It was the largest painting at the Centennial. There were thousands, by the way. There were huge displays of art, American, European, some Asian. And the Civil War is only 10 years past in 1870s, 11 years past. But its shadow, it still casts a shadow over the United States. The organizers of the Centennial bent over backwards to try to accommodate Southern feelings in the name of national reconciliation. And that reconciliation, by the way, is largely taking place at the expense of Black Americans, who are discriminated against at the Centennial in various ways.
Well, for example, was there any Black art included in the exhibition?
Well, yes, there were a couple of pieces. The most important and the most famous was a sculpture of the Death of Cleopatra in beautiful white Carrara marble by a woman named Edmonia Lewis, who was a Black American, although she identified primarily as Black, but she was also half Native American. She was from New York State.
Well, I wondered about that, though, because she claimed to be born in a wigwam. I mean, did they have wigwams in New York?
Well, they did, but she wasn't born in one. She had a talent for marketing herself. Mm-hmm. And indeed, she was the first American sculptor to travel to California. And she lived in Italy by this time, but she came to the U.S. to sell her sculptures. She was very, very successful. And she traveled to California on one lengthy trip. And she showed her sculpture in various places, mostly around the Bay Area. And to do so, she set up a wigwam. She called her gallery A Wigwam, and it looked like a wigwam. But to be fair, it sounds kind of quaint, but she was a great sculptor, and she was possibly the wealthiest Black American woman in her time. Because she sold so well.
And she was college educated, went to Oberlin College.
Yeah.
That was impressive, I thought, because that in her day, my goodness.
Yeah.
Her attending Oberlin College. And also, you mentioned Italy. She was awarded a gold medal by the King of Italy.
Yes.
And so somebody said that when they visited her in Italy, she had lived there so long, her English had an Italian accent to it.
That was Frederick Douglass, by the way.
Oh, yes. So this woman, you include a photograph of her next to her statue, and she her name comes up a lot in many of the chapters of your book for various reasons. So she keeps appearing. She was small, and you have a photograph of her and this photograph of the sculpture of Cleopatra. And even some people wonder about the racial makeup of Cleopatra herself. Do you have any feelings about why she chose to present a statue of Cleopatra, an Egyptian?
Yes. Cleopatra descended from a line of Greek kings, pharaohs nominally, but Greek lineage that had existed since Egypt was conquered by Alexander the Great. That said, but in the 19th century, Cleopatra was a favorite subject of romantic sculptors, tragic death, and who really knew Cleopatra primarily through Shakespeare's play, Antony and Cleopatra, but to others, specifically abolitionists and artists who favored abolitionism, she was identified as an African, because Egypt is geographically in Africa. And that was an element, I think, in Edmonia Lewis's choice of sculpting Cleopatra. However, she does not look African at all. She looks Greek in the statue. The statue, by the way, is in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and it can be seen today. It's quite beautiful. I mean, it's a neoclassical statue. This isn't a particularly favored style at all today, but it's very fine of its type, and she was her masterpiece.
You just mentioned it is now in the Smithsonian, in a museum there in Washington, but that's not what she had hoped to sell it, and she was successful in being able to just be there and defy racial assumptions. And even though her name is a little unusual, Edmonia, but when she was buried in London, she was buried as Mary Lewis, and she lived into this, the 1907. But this statue that, it had a really unusual history itself. Once it didn't sell, what happened to it between then and now in the Smithsonian?
Yeah, it's kind of a sad story. Her asking price, I believe, was $30,000, which was an enormous sum. Yeah, an enormous sum. It had cost her a great deal to acquire the marble. She had Italian stone cutters working for her in Italy to pay their salaries and to ship it all the way to Philadelphia and to maintain it and herself in Philadelphia. So it was very costly. She didn't sell it. She finally left it behind in Chicago in hope that it would sell, and eventually, one way or another, I don't have the price that was finally paid. It wound up in a bar in Chicago, and was passed from one hand to another, and eventually rediscovered by an art historian in the 1990s, unless I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, recently,
basically in a rubbish dump.
Yeah, and that was rather startling. It was so heavy. I was amazed how heavy the thing was, but to end up in a junkyard and not even rediscovered until 1990. Now, on a sweeter note, I found it sweet. I found it romantic because we all know Alexander Graham Bell's name because he invented the telephone. But I was surprised and pleased, really, to hear how he even, I'm not going to take my telephone. I'm not going to go to that centennial. So who persuaded him to attend and take his device?
I should say, by way of preface, that the telephone was exhibited for the first time at the centennial. And it was a sensation. And it was so brilliant an invention that it was put in commercial production in less than a year. Remarkable. Anyway. You asked, well, how did he get there if he didn't want to go? Which is a wonderful teaser, because it was his fiancée, later his wife, who essentially shanghaied him onto a train. And I said, Alex, you really have to go. And he didn't realize he was actually being sent to Philadelphia until he was on the train. And she also had arranged for her brother to get his apparatus, the phone, onto the train as well. And he's writing telegrams while at each stop of the train saying, I want to go back to Boston, which is where his laboratory is. I don't really want to go. He's a charming man, wonderful, warm, sensitive, very forward-looking and enlightened individual. He looms large in the book, partly because of the telephone, but also because his letters, often to his fiancée, wife, and to his own family, are just wonderful. They're very revealing of himself in a degree that's not so common in the 19th century. So he was a lot of fun to write about.
Well, I read something in your book that when I sat down behind this microphone, I thought, thank you, Alexander Graham Bell. I didn't know that he invented the first microphone.
He did. He kept churning out inventions, quite interesting ones, well into the 20th century, including a viable airplane. People associate him just with the telephone, but he never stopped creating.
Well, and I can just imagine here in 1876 that I see this guy make a phone call to Boston, 43 miles away. I would have had no idea that was possible. So I can just imagine why his invention grew so quickly, the telephone.
But people instantly understood what it could do. And it was even predicted then that it would transform American life. A lot of jokes are made, say, about when primitive automobiles started appearing. People thought, oh, it'll never replace the horse. That was not the case with the telephone. People wanted them as soon as they could get them. And as I said, it was in commercial production within a year.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with author Fergus Bordewick, and we'll continue our conversation about the Great Fair of 1876. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Fergus M. Bordewick, and his book is Centennial, The Great Fair of 1876 and the Invention of America's Future. So in 1876, our country was 100 years old, and it was cause for celebration. Now, we talked about admiral people like President Hayes. But there was a guy that didn't like that much. But he stood to benefit. If you get millions of people wanting to come to Philadelphia, how are they going to get there?
Well, I think you're talking about Tom Scott.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was a good-looking guy. You've got his photograph in there.
Yeah, Tom Scott is a fascinating individual. In his own day, people knew his name the way there were new people, the names of people running for the presidency, famous writers and poets. But he was an industrialist of the first order, a classical Gilded Age mogul. He was president of the Pennsylvania Railroad, which was the largest corporation in the world at the time. It was regarded also as probably the best run corporation at that time. And Tom Scott took the Pennsylvania Railroad from a more or less local line in Pennsylvania and made it a national line. That's to say, through acquiring railroads all over the country, his ambition was to bring it all the way to California, to San Diego. Didn't quite make it, but he got close. So Tom Scott is a classic 19th century self-made man. Came from very modest beginnings, and he turned this corporation into a national power. Now, what does he have to do with the Centennial Exhibition? Well, everybody who went there had to get there on a railroad, and that railroad was the Pennsylvania Railroad. So the corporation stood to do very well by this, and so it was also the lead sponsor for the Centennial. He was ruthless. John D. Rockefeller, a competitor, he was better known than John D. Rockefeller at the time. Rockefeller said he was a brilliant railroad man, but he was a son of a bitch, and many things of that sort. Some of them probably not repeatable on your show were said about Tom Scott because he was ruthless and relentless.
Well, for example, he would satisfy his investors, and to do that, he would just reduce wages of people who are already just homeless and workers. And to satisfy his investors, he'd reduce wages. Another reason that, as a reader, I didn't care for that guy.
Well, he was a way of writing about Scott, who does loom large in my book. It was a way of looking at American capitalism in the 1870s. Which became, in that decade, the great driving force of the American economy, much more than it had been previously. And Scott epitomized that. Yes, he was ruthless to his workers because there was no social safety net in those days. Zero. There was no social security. None. There was no job security. None. Any employer could fire any employee whenever he felt like it. And the United States was in the backwash of a terrible depression that began in 1873 and was known at the time as the Great Depression until the one of the 1930s superseded it. And during that depression, employers, including the Pennsylvania Railroad, cut wages not by nickels and dimes, by 10%, 20%, 30%, occasionally by as much as 50%, impoverishing workers. And I'll repeat, there was no social safety net of any kind. And so writing about Scott was a way of talking, as I said, about American capitalism and how industry operated at the time. It's making America great as an industrial power, but it's making America also shameful as an exploiter of working people.
Well, I don't think many people have heard of Tom Scott, but somebody that I think everybody's heard of, that maybe reading your book, they might change their opinion of. Do you know perhaps who I'm thinking of that was rather nice looking young man? And that was Custer.
Yeah. Earlier on in our conversation, you quoted General William Tecumseh Sherman, who was present at the Centennial, by the way, in the summer of 1876. You quoted him exclaiming something to the effect that this can't happen.
It's almost too terrible to be true. Yeah, yeah.
Terrible to be true. What he's talking about was the extermination of General Custer's command, the 7th Cavalry, in the war against the Sioux and Cheyenne in what later becomes Montana Territory, which occurred, the defeat of Custer's command occurred at the end of June in 76. But news takes some days to reach Philadelphia. I believe it reached Philadelphia on July 5th, the day after the 4th of July. And you have to imagine the how Americans were stunned, shocked by the, in the midst of the celebrations of American power and history by trying to come to grips with something that they thought could not have happened. An American army wiped out, I mean, it was about 270 men, but wiped out by Native Americans. And Custer, I introduced Custer into the book partly as a way of communicating how Americans felt about that shock, not unlike the feeling that some Americans might have had in recent weeks, realizing that the United States in the Middle East in the Persian Gulf was basically defeated by Iran. People have often drawn that analogy for me.
I didn't know that Custer had written a memoir. You said a couple of years before then, 1874, Custer wrote a memoir. He was a very self-confident guy.
He was a good writer, actually. He had been a school teacher before he became a soldier. He was quite a good writer, I would say, for that era. Straightforward, good narrative pace. His wife, Libby, probably collaborated in writing it. She lived until 1939 and cultivated his memory all those many, many years. He's not a sympathetic character, mm-hmm. General Custer. He was a brutal soldier in the Indian Wars. On the other hand, if one were to read his book, you realize that he actually had a sense of empathy for the native peoples he was fighting. He wasn't devoid of that. He was a complex and fairly well-educated man.
Well, another factor that got people's interest in the Black Hills was gold.
Believe it or not, I don't think most Americans realize this, the federal government had a policy of actually keeping settlers out of the Black Hills under Grant. Grant's, as it was called, Grant's Indian policy was enlightened for the time, not by today's standards, but very much so by 19th century standards. He pursued what he called a peace policy towards Native Americans, towards the tribes, and did not seek to start wars against the Native tribes. Okay. The Black Hills. Gold was found in the Black Hills. That message was communicated to America by General Custer, who headed an expedition that explored the Black Hills. And once that information had become public in the East, it was the focus of a gold rush, not unlike California's gold rush. And there was, at that point, no stopping of the invasion of the hills by white settlers, the settlement, and in short order, as Native people defended themselves, war followed on its heels. And it was that war in which Custer himself was killed in 1876. But the coda to that defeat of Custer, of course, was that the army redoubled its forces in the area, and the Indians, Sioux, Cheyenne, and Arapaho, were finally defeated and wound up, with very few exceptions, being resettled on reservations.
Yeah, I noticed the terminology. The New York Times wrote about savage tribes. That's how we viewed the Native Americans, which we were calling Indians, as savage tribes. So here we are thinking, oh, Custer was a hero, and he didn't live to be that old, but we know more. Your book helps us to fill out our understanding of Custer better, that he was, at one point, Custer's clueless ineptitude, not in his view, of course. My guest is Fergus Bordewick, and his book is Centennial, The Great Fair of 1876 and the Invention of America's Future. Now, we've talked about some of the main players in your book, and we haven't really talked about how, well, the Custer killed Native Americans, but there was a massacre that took place that I even hate to mention it. It was the Hamburg Massacre. Do you have anything you want to say about that?
Sure. And to give your listeners a bit more of a context here, I mean, my book is about the Great Centennial and how it was celebrated, but I move outward from it to really look at what's happening in America in that year of 1876. And part of what's happening is the disintegration of Reconstruction in the South. The Ku Klux Klan has been active for several years. President Grant has defeated the Klan, and he's been prosecuting Klansmen. But nevertheless, attacks against freed people, Black men who can now vote, thanks to the 15th Amendment, are being driven at gunpoint or by threats away from the polls across the South. And in South Carolina, in July of 1876, Black Americans who are members of the local militia, state-sanctioned militia, are massacred by whites who are not Klansmen, because they're not in any disguises. They are simply a kind of self-appointed white militia force that is determined to cleanse their kind of word, cleanse the town of Hamburg of what they call Black rule, because Black office holders are plentiful in that area. Listeners might not be aware that during Reconstruction, at least 2,000 African Americans held political, mostly elective office in the South under the auspices of the biracial Republican Party, which it was at the time. And the real target of the Klan and white supremacists was to destroy that biracial Republican Party and to drive Black office holders out of office and Black voters away from the polls. So news of the Hamburg massacre reaches Philadelphia just after what's also called the Custer massacre reaches Philadelphia. Two great shocks to the system.
Well, at one point, the Blacks are referred to as dregs of the population. Oh, my gosh. But then the editor of the Charleston, South Carolina paper was challenged to a duel. Gosh. It amazes me how, well, and then the grand juries would just kind of wink their eyes at, oh, yeah, these white guys did this, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody, although there was a nominal prosecution of the killers at the Hamburg massacre, not a soul was ever convicted or sentenced. If I may, I'll mention my previous book, Klan War, Ulysses Grant and this Battle to Save Reconstruction, deals with those events in great detail. And if anybody's interested, you know, I go very, very deep into what Southern politics were like at the time. And I mean, even in South Carolina, there were white South Carolinians who were Republicans who were allied with Black South Carolinians in an effort to create this two-party system, which failed because Reconstruction came to an end really as a result of the election of 1876. Even though a Republican won the election, he prevailed only by allowing white supremacist Democrats to regain power in several states in the South, and they put an end to Reconstruction.
Well, your book is a fascinating read, I find. We didn't even get to the Molly Maguires, so I think people might like to read that, or women and what they were doing at the time to benefit women. So thank you for writing this book.
Well, thank you, Nancy, and thank you for your wonderful questions. I mean, as you can tell, I'm happy to talk about the centennial and this period, which helped shape the America that we live in.
The book again is Centennial, The Great Fair of 1876 and the Invention of America's Future. And the author is Fergus M. Bordewick. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Winter. Even love has its winter, when the gray windows of your eyes will not let me in. The world then is blacks and dripping browns, tree branches stripped to twigs, autumn leaves matted by rain, and boots to brown mush. Love contents itself with little gestures, clusters of pale pink buds, some nearly white, among jade-gray manzanita leaves, timid colors scatter along a trail in dead of winter. In hard rains, living things seek their holes. Just so, when we turn inward to fears, the space of our love contracts. Our hearts squeezed to a corner, forgotten. We feel alone, conscious in our hibernation. It is then we need a lover's faith. In our January, we fear what we were is dying, but this dying feeds what we will be, though we see only briefest glimmers like pink buds along a trail. Our love flows underground for a while. We'll gather, burst into flowering, ripening, harvesting. We will push away our fears, worldly cares, and somewhere, somehow, the space of our love will glimmer open. We will see new blossoms, flowers from a new world, and we will feed on its nectar. Thank God, though, we do not obey the seasons in all ways. That passion will not endure a long, cold wait for spring. The shape of our love is short winters, long springs and summers, and especially long autumns, where we leave not a single ripe, unplucked berry on the vine. Michelle Small.
Photos of my brother and me. Pressed together between the glass and picture frames, we keep ourselves in memory. Side by side, in front of our house that held us, we stand together, stiff and still. A foot apart in front of Grandpa's grave, we look our separate ways into the distance. My arm around him, we sit on the couch in matching jackets with tight grins, bouncing up and down. I call his name and ask him, "Who am I?" And he excels my name in soft breaths back to me. We are sealed in frames of time held deep in each other's mind. Joan Goodrow.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.